Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we'll have the usual ingredient of the week. We'll be answering all your foodie questions. And we have 8 times All-Ireland winner for the Dirty Dubs. 8. Yeah, it was enough. Philly.
That's never enough.
Philly McMahon, who's an absolute superstar. Really looking forward to that chat.
Too.
Gareth, look, I often have a slag with Philly. I've known him a long time, but What an icon of the beautiful game as well.
I was telling you, he trained my nephew.
Yeah, he was involved in Bows, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's a professional footballer. And
that's Jamie Mullins, for anybody that doesn't know Gareth's nephew, Jamie.
Yeah, when Jay was started with Bows, I think it was just at the end when he was coming towards the end of Kevin's, when he was about 14 or 15.
Mm.
Philly helped him with a lot of his explosive work, I think.
Yeah,
I think
doing the strength and conditioning work.
Yeah, and really brought him on. He was a good baller anyway, but
I've seen Jamie play. He's with Brighton now, so he's in Evan Ferguson territory. So
yeah.
Let's remember that name, actually. So yeah, don't go anywhere. Okay, so it is ingredient of the week, Gaz. You're going to go first.
The hardest bit of the show.
I know. We can never. We are.
Put them down and have them on a list. I was like, did I say that one?
I know. We're on the last episode of season 2. Sad. Cue the sad music.
Yeah.
And just like the gadgets, we started running out of ingredients as well. Who knew that there were so few ingredients that we really did love? What are you going to go with?
Well, I'm going to go. I suppose there's millions of ingredients that we both love, right? But it's trying to say things that kind of have a bit of weight on what we think.
Resonate with the home.
Yeah, what you're going to, the listener is going to enjoy. So I'm going to throw rice into the mixer because there's so many different varieties. There's so many different things you can do with it. And really, I think most people cook long grain, you know, like that's their go-to. But I really think, you know,
it's a bit easier than the basmati.
It's much easier to cook, right? And yeah, I think it's marketed better, and especially here in Ireland. But basmati, for me, it just gives you so much more flavour.
Yeah.
So if I'm having a curry, I'm definitely cooking basmati, definitely. Yeah. Or jasmine even. It has that fragrant, not only smell, but taste. And I think,
for me, you got to have a few cardamom pods in the water for jasmine rice.
Like 3 cardamom pods.
Change your life.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because I don't have a rice cooker.
Pierce Hingston, an old school chef, I had him for a period of time on a college placement. He taught me a method that no matter the quantity, 18 minutes in a preheated oven, I think it's 170, 80 degrees, and cartouche on top, lid on top
of
the pot.
That just means a piece of parchment paper.
A piece of parchment paper that you fold up fancy, you cut it. It just smothers covers the lid of whatever's in there. Then you put a lid on the pot, and regardless if it's enough rice for 5 people or rice for 200 people, in 18 minutes it will be perfect every single time.
What it is that, especially if you buy an aged basmati, like not in the supermarket, but if you go to one of the Asian stores, just give it a good rinse. And then generally speaking with rice, it's 2 parts liquid to 1 part rice. So Gary was just saying there, like it's kind of like a pilaf method. So you can put cardamom pods, a couple of knobs of butter, a bit of turmeric, you know, and you can go where you want with it. And then just pop it into a preheated oven and 18, 20 minutes later.
It's key to know that once the rice is cooked and the pour is full, it's very difficult to season it. So it's imperative that the cooking liquor is bang on, because you get the cooking liquor right, you get rice right.
Yeah, and look, it'd be remiss of me not to talk about risotto if we're talking about rice. So, you know, then you're into the world of arborio or... and again,
Carnaroli.
I think a lot of people at home probably don't understand it. Like the difference between trying to cook jasmine or long grain or basmati, you're trying not to agitate the rice at all because you don't want the starch to come out. Where in the world of risotto, it's the total opposite of that. You want the starch to come out because that's where the creamy texture comes
from. And that's how you thicken it, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, like, very simply, it's a shallot or an onion fried off and some good olive oil. Then the rice goes in, it's toasted. Then it's kissed with some wine. I always remember a chef telling me that risotto rice is born in water, so it must die in wine. I was a commie chef and it's stuck with me for my whole career. So anytime I teach risotto, hey, look, you're going to use that now. Watch Gary, have you ever seen him cooking?
I'm fucking stealing that line for sure.
Rattle it out. It's mine. Anyway, and then all you do is you just feed it after the wine disappears. You just start feeding it with hot stock until the rice is cooked.
I was just thinking about somebody born in a big swimming pool of water, like born in water, died in wine. If you became famous, it's a great autobiography title, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then right at the end, you just take it off the heat. You let it sit for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then that's where the flavour comes in. You have to add Parmesan cheese and butter.
Yeah.
That's a very simple...
A basic risotto. And one little trick you mentioned about the starch or rice, and that is something, and look, we're not sponsored by Uncle Ben's, but you know, if anybody at Uncle Ben's would care to do so, we would welcome it. But I always use Uncle Ben's simply because it's the only grain really that you don't have to wash. But I mean, if you don't use an Uncle Grain or an Uncle Ben rice grain for long grain, you got to cover your rice grain with cold water, mix it, strain it off 3 times, and then cover it with your liquid, your 2 parts liquid to 1 part rice. Otherwise, it's just going to be super cloudy, sticky and messy. Whereas that's a pre-par cooked, washed grain with Uncle Ben's, and it goes straight from the box to the pot. And for boys, it goes to just, they're always in a hurry. It's brilliant. But you got to know that if you're not using that particular, and as I say, we've no affiliation with them, but it's important to know that you got to rinse long grain rice 3 times.
And the last type of rice, I didn't know I had so much information about rice, but the last type of rice is sushi rice.
Yeah.
And cooking sushi rice is an art. And it's one that once you master it, it's no problem. But my kids love, they call it sticky rice, but it's where you cook, you use much less water. It's 1 part rice to 1.5 times water. And then after, it takes about 15 minutes to cook. So cold, salted water, you bring it up to a simmer and then very gently cook it for 15 minutes, take it off, and you season it with rice wine vinegar, mirin, and a little bit of sugar. And it kind of makes the rice a little bit sweet and tart, exactly like what's in your nigiri rolls or your sushi.
How long will a sushi chef have to make rice before they're a sushi master?
Isn't it 7 years?
Yes, it's 7 years.
I worked in a sushi restaurant in Sydney.
Wow. Irish head on you.
Yeah, exactly. Big sun. I had the sunglasses marks and all. But I used to train in a gym
Wore one of them Miyagi aren't head.
Yeah, exactly. All the gear, man. All the gear, no idea. No, but I used to train in this gym and I always used to go in to this sushi bar afterwards and I'd be sitting up at the bar and I'd order a green tea, Total Notions, right? And I'd be having a bit of sushi. And then this one time I just went, come here, is there any chance I could come in here and just do a few shifts? And I was like, yeah, perfect.
I wouldn't eat sushi if you give it to me for nothing.
Stop.
Shocking. Why? Stuff. Fucking rotten.
Tell us what you really think.
Absolute. Skyward.
Anyway, on that note.
Yeah, not for
What's your ingredient of the week?
My ingredient of the week is the humble turnip.
A turnip. Idiot.
I have listened to more shite about sushi rice in the last 30 seconds
than
I care to ever. I grew up in Donegal and the turnip is the daddy. All right? So there you go.
All right.
Shove your sushi rice up your hole sideways.
You have to be cooking it 7 years before you can.
Well, a turnip, in about 7 minutes, I can make you a Jedi master. You know what I mean? I will have you king of the turnips in no time at all. 7 years. What a load of bollocks.
What's the difference between a turnip and a Swede?
A turnip and a Swede is the size, really, and a rutabaga. All it is really the size.
I always wonder that. Like some chefs call them turnips.
You trying to catch me out? You want to be up fucking early, big boy.
Catch me out on the sushi. That's a cracker. Oh, man. How do you got them sushi, the turnip?
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is how I eat my turnips. How do you
Oh, here we have to wrap up ingredients of the week. Gary can talk about it.
The ancient art compared to the Japanese going back thousands of years. Gary,
hold up.
What the fuck was I thinking?
Oh, stuff.
Why did I not read?
Why did I not rethink it? I sound like a fucking hillbilly.
I'll raise you a turnip.
Like, I see your sushi 85 ways for rice. Fucking turnips. Do you know what? Cover them with butter and honey, and that's all I have to say about turnips.
Make sure you season them.
Oh, I put Japanese music in behind.
Fuck it, anyway. Yeah, I made a prick of myself there. Today, we've got a great guest, arguably one of the greatest to ever play the game of Gaelic football. Gym owner, business owner, he's in the food business, that's why we have him here. I've got to cook alongside this boy at one stage as well. Philly McMahon, 11, or what, 8 All-Irelands, I'm going to think.
I wish it was 11.
I wish it was 11, yeah. You're lucky.
There's people getting close. Yeah, true. Yeah. True.
Yeah, count your lucky chickens, you know. Imagine how Aidan O'Shea felt hearing that. Good to see you, Philly.
That's great. Thanks for having me on, lads. It's great to be here.
So how's life? How have you been since I saw you a couple of years ago, I'd say now?
Yeah, yeah. Since we've done the show at the restaurant. Yeah. Loved it. I was a big fan of it before I'd done it. And I was blown away by the experience. As I said, after, the only problem with the whole show is you don't get to do it again.
Yeah.
You know, but sure, look, that's the things in life, you know, that are worthwhile. Is,
what blew you? What impression?
The operation of it, first of all, the three guys and the sous chefs, what they could do in that time frame.
Had you any experience of a professional kitchen world before that?
Yeah, I had it was more of a manufacturing kitchen, I suppose. Okay. I had a company called Fitfield and I merged with a company called NutriQuick, which I'm a co-owner now of. So that was my experience, but always loved food. Before we had our son, Lennon, myself and my wife Sarah would be out every weekend trying different restaurants around Dublin and across the country if you were doing staying down the country somewhere. But I suppose, yeah, a big foodie lover and I had planned on doing the restaurant show and I couldn't because my dad was ill.
Right.
And then he passed away and then they came back to me and said, would you do it? And I said, lovely, I'll do it. And we had all the recipes and all the meals done because I was about to push the button on it, But it was emotional as well because, I don't know, it was because I was fatigued from being in the kitchen looking at you. I definitely didn't do the work you did it. But because it was the whole menu represented me, my family, where I'm from, my dad, my wife and stuff like that. So it's a brilliant experience. Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
Try to ruin my career.
Yeah, so this man done a Dublin coddle.
It was the first one I ever made as well.
I was so impressed by it. I still crave it today. Because it was not like the coddle that I'd make or my mum would make. And that my mum would kill me for saying that.
You'll start lashing the fuck cubes into what I'd say.
No. It was unbelievable. Oh, there was so many stages to it, wasn't there?
Well, I reached out to the king of Coddle, Ciarán, at the Gravediggers. And I've said it a few times.
We actually spoke about it
on here. I don't know what had it, maybe Paddy's Day or whatever had us talking about it, but I was raging whenever the show aired because obviously we have no control over the edit, Philly, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But Ciarán is famous for it. The Gravediggers is famous for it. That's in your neck of the woods as well.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to do Dublin proud and do you proud. And
And Stephen was ready to jump on you as well.
Stephen's a Kilbarrick boy. He was breathing down my neck. I'd literally never made it before. And I was going, I'm going to follow the recipe to the T. And it was unbelievable. I've never, ever concentrated on a dish as much. And you would think it's simple. I never, honestly, God, hand on heart. I'm a big fan of Phillies anyway. I'm a GAA fan. And there's no point in me telling a lie. There's some people come in and Philip, the owner of VMP, is always saying to me, he goes, it's amazing how you kick into gear when the sports stars are in.
Because
I'm a fan of nearly all of them, you know what I mean? And I'm
only short of wearing your boots in the gym.
I know. And I'm
fully, you got shin guards on there?
Yeah, I'm fully invested to make sure that they get as many stars as possible. But then Philly, obviously, and his wife eat out a lot. So he turned coddle, which is a main course, into a starter. But then his second dish was literally the most elegant dumpling.
The total opposite, wasn't it?
the dump.
What was it?
Lobster dumpling.
Yeah.
With a pickled enoki mushroom and a
coconut. Where did you see that? Or where did that come from?
That was in Oliver Dunn's restaurant, Cleaver East. Yeah, we loved that starter. It was definitely the idea was a north side, south side thing at the beginning, a real kind of Dublin coddle, and then maybe a
real
posh. I mean,
it was one extreme to the other. It was. I mean, like that dish. Filling.
I never knew the coddle out the south side.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. It's definitely the coddle was down the north side. The Dublin lads wouldn't know what that is.
So I reached out to Oliver and I goes, look, Philly's coming in. He's got this dish. Do you remember? I think it was off the menu. And he goes, oh, yeah, I goes,
we send you the recipe.
He sent me a photograph.
Even
he goes,
better.
If I get a picture, I can make it. Showed it to Philly and he's like, oh, that's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
It was top class.
The lemongrass. What would you call it? It wouldn't be a sauce. What would
it be? It was a coconut milk. Lemon lime emulsion, all
yeah,
you know
was,
what I mean.
Oh, you drink it alone, like,
yeah.
You know.
We really did know it was a good job whenever we got it all put together. And we came up with something that day. I think, one of the boys, Chris, who's the head chef in Cellar 22 now, he might have come across this scallop mousseline at that time. And I was like, well, do you know what? If I poach some lobster and I fold in that, I'll put that in the dumpling. It was outrageous, man. Yeah. So a few of us got involved in that one as well, like to make it right. But I don't even know what you had for your main course. I can't even remember.
The main I had, I had this kind of fish platter. It was like all different kind of seafood on the plate. And that was taken from, see, these are all the restaurants that I'm taken from, you know, like that was taken from, Michael's, is it? Is it Michael's?
Yeah, that's right.
He does a brilliant dish, and like there's a bit of meat on it. There's lobster, but it's like a mixture of a seafood platter. And then we did. I'm a big steak lover, so we done a Chateaubriand with the. Remember, we done the burnt ends. Mash.
Oh, Jesus.
Yes. And it was incredible. It was incredible.
That's
and
right.
And even the greens.
It's all coming back to me.
I have a picture of it and it's perfect on the plate. Like, you know.
Outrageous, actually.
What did you get? What size?
Four.
Robbed.
And it was the...
Robbed.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get four, but you were a five. Yeah. We thought you were a five.
The desserts, we did like buns, but it was kind of like based off my dad being from West Belfast and... he would have when we came down from the north, I'd go up every couple of weeks with him, but when he'd come back down he'd bring buns, Belfast buns with him.
Well, great.
And it was my fault, in fairness, it was all similar.
Right, okay.
We needed probably
a
little more texture.
And we'd done an eating mess, but it was kind of a Dublin mess with a blueberry kind of effect to it. I probably should have kind of thought a bit more into it, but in fairness.
Well, I got the dish of the day all across the board that night. And to be fair to Stevie, the main course is usually where most people like put a lot of the love, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's fucking easy.
When did food start becoming a big part of your life, or is it right since being very young, or?
I think so. As far as I can remember going back, my dad was the type of person, my mum was the cook, and she'd have our set meals every couple of days, you know, your stews, your spaghetti bolognese. Even today, my mum's spaghetti bolognese is like out in the balcony. She lives in a three-story terrace out in the balcony in the summer, garlic bread. So it's gorgeous. But so I suppose I had that side of food from my mum, the traditional side of things. But my dad was like crazy in the kitchen. Like, he'd put all of these, and he wouldn't know what he's doing. Like, but he'd put all these different things from the press in, and it'd be amazing.
Wow.
Absolutely loved making a different salad. And I'd be saying, what did you put in that? And he said, just a little bit out of the fridge, a little bit out of the press. And he'd be like, it was lovely. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So, so I suppose
he was a Belfast boy, wasn't he? He probably loved the likes of liver and kidneys and the offal.
Do you know what he loved? Dullis.
Dullis.
I couldn't put it in my mouth. It was too salty, but he used to love and all his friends.
Grew up on it.
Dullis.
Yeah. Top class, man, yeah.
Very trendy ingredient in today's world, isn't it?
It is, but
it's something that's been there forever. But a lot of the high end kitchens now use it for seasoning and it's had a real Renaissance.
Bread and bread. It's a lovely seasoner for bread, for panna cottas.
Amazing to season scallops.
He just used to take it out of the packet and put it in his mouth.
That's how we had it. We would just eat it out of the bag, brown bag. Couldn't we would just watch a film and sit down and drink that and then ask the old boy for get a wee bottle of football special. But that's something.
That's how all the Donegal players are monsters.
Exactly.
In the Dullis.
That's what we ate. We just ate Dullis. Well, we call it Dullis, or Dillisk or Dullis, but sometimes, like, some of them would maybe dry it too much, or stuff that came from Fannett Shores. I always felt there's fucking more salt in the water there.
Right.
And my aunt in law, she used to bring it down, like, and the Dins were big fishermen in Fannett, and they would have made dolls, and I say, geez, he goes, give us a bag of dolls because that's psycho salty. And the old boy really liked the overly salty bag, and so did I, but your lips would be withered in on top of you, you know what I mean? And be trying to scull a bottle of water or football special.
He was strange, like, in terms of those. Like, and again, it's not to you because you're from the north. Like, you probably have some similarities. But, like, even to in the summer, we'd go and we'd collect periwinkles.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd put them in a pot and you'd hear them crackling. Them and I loved collecting them. Never could eat.
Did you not know?
No, could never eat.
If you could get your head out of how disgusting they look, you know, because you got to eat them with
But it's
pin,
not even that
know?
Because I'd eat most kind of foods that look like texture. That. Haven't tried snail now, but I've tried everything. Yeah. Most things anyway. But I just couldn't.
Couldn't get my head around it. School, we work with periwinkles and oysters, wild oysters, the old boy. And us from, I was 8 or 9, like that. So we worked in the shores of North Donegal, like doing periwinkles. That is a fucking tough graft, man.
I'd say so. We used to go out to Skerries, but it was a whole day of it, like, and it's. Brings you back to your childhood thinking of it with your
bring them home to wash them. Granny was the only one who cooked them. The old boy wouldn't eat them. Nobody in the family would eat them apart from my granny, God rest her. But she'd throw up a big bowl and round again, and we used to eat them. But I mean, I wouldn't eat them now, weirdly enough. But back then, I'd tear into them. Yeah.
And do you know what? He used to get mussels and he'd get them in a jar.
Yeah.
And they'd have a sauce and he'd eat out of the jar. That type of stuff.
Come here, going to the football career then, Philly. When did you know you were standing out from the crowd? Like, when was the big break? Ballymun Kickhams is your club, right?
Yes. Yeah. I suppose I was never a standout player at a young age. I was on the development squads with Dublin. I probably had a different energy to a lot of kids because of the issue I had at home. My brother struggling with addiction, and that was vented on the pitch then, so I became a very aggressive kind of tough defender.
You were a thug.
Only to Donegal players. Maybe the West Coast.
Yeah. When was that, 14, 15? 16?
Well, I got on the development squads, played minor, which is kind of 17 and 18 back then. It's a little bit earlier now. And then I suppose 20 and 21 was the real kind of change physically. I wasn't small, but I wasn't huge either. But physically, I started to really get after. I was working in the gym industry at the age of 17, so I started kind of developing physically. Probably. Yeah. So I remember working in DCU, and the 21s were in getting tested. And actually, I worked in the Elite Performance Gym in DCU, and I was on the 21s team. And the top nine people were from Ballymun Kickhams out of the Dublin team. Top nine.
Why?
I would imagine Paddy Christie had us doing strength and conditioning probably a lot earlier than most of the clubs. So the top nine had a better training edge than the other players. And I suppose my first year of 21s, I played every game. I was a year younger, but I played every game, every friendly up to the championship game. And I won't mention the manager's name, but then he didn't play me. He didn't put me on the bench for the first game. He got beaten by Mead. And I suppose along my career, there's been those things have happened to me, like those little adversity things. And I've been very aware of those, that there's an opportunity at the end of them. Because the following year, I was the captain for the 21s under Jim Gavin. That was his first year. So, and me and Dermot Connolly were the only players on that 21 squad playing senior that year. Because that was my debut 2008 for the senior Dublin team. And then I got dropped in 2009. Again, from that experience, I went, well, this is just another one. So I could have went
out. What did it do? Did it make you say, I need to train harder, I need to really go after this more, I need to prove them wrong? Or like, what was the...
I think unconsciously, when the 21s thing, I was in the gym industry, I started lashing the gym out of it, I was in it every day, I was surrounded by it. So that was a huge benefit. But there was a bit of hurt there.
Right.
When I got dropped by Pat Gilroy in 2009, that was really hurtful. And that's when...
Is that the one you're not going to mention his name?
No. He was the senior manager. But he came on the scene after Pillar Caffrey.
That really was... He changed the culture, did he?
The way you always hear that, like, Dublin... Back then, it was like Dublin are just... They're more prepared, they're better. Mm. And from where I was working and seeing... Like, I was around English sports teams coming in to stay where I was working. And I was like... The nutrition was such a huge part of it. The training was a given, but also the psychology that went into sport. Mm. And I was like, I says, if I'm ever talking to one of the Dubs, I'm going to ask them, did all that roll in at the same time? And was that what was it given the edge, do you think? Or?
Well, Gilroy came in. Look, Caffrey, Pillar Caffrey had done a really good job. And I suppose the pain and suffering of, let's say, 16 years, like we won it in 2011 under Pat Gilroy, but 13, 14 years of not winning in All-Ireland, what happened was the county board really put serious work in behind the scenes with the clubs.
Right.
Everybody had a GPO, you know, that's a player's officer that supported the coaching element of the game. And they got structurally things right. Like the
grassroots, you mean?
Grassroots, right down. Yeah. And, okay. And there's loads of people we can thank for that, but certainly John Costlow was one of the main instigators of that, and they created this kind of strategy called the Blue Wave. So in that, like, if that didn't happen, you'd be saying, is it luck? What happened? Is there just a great group of lads? Is there a great group of management coming in? But that work was put in, and then all of these players start to flourish because of those clubs putting in the effort. So because there's certain things that Caffrey done, that Gilroy done, but just it just changed the dynamics of the culture of where it was at. So, for example, when I first got on the team with Caffrey, they had this book called The Blue Book, and it was like a big kind of secret. And everybody uses diaries now. Right. Everybody at that level. I'd say you walk into a changing room and a person, if they're doing a meeting, hasn't got a diary, they're just not at the level.
Right.
They're not taking notes. They're not understanding. They're not learning their sport. They're not learning their trade, So I first got on the team in 2008, and the defensive coach, who I'm very fond of still to this day, because he gave me so many tough lessons. And I walked in, he says, right, I want you to do an analysis on that game. I know you didn't play, but I want you to do an analysis on it. So cool. So I came in with a one page, I wrote everything out by hand, and the next session, and I'm kind of sitting there, and there's lads with books, there's lads with 5 or 6 pages on it, and I'm just like, no. Oh shit. Yeah. So he just came over to me, had a look, and he says, what's that? I was like, oh, that's the analysis on the game. He says, okay, come here. So he set me down beside Paul Casey, who was brilliant at all that. And he said, look at this. Go through that. And he said, this is the way we do things here. And the same session, he hit me twice. I went out to train and I had Ballium and Kickham's gear on. He says, you're not training with Ballium and Kickham's here. I says, I've no Dublin gear. Give me Dublin gear and I'll wear it. And he's like, that's a fair point. I'll get it for you next time. Don't ever wear club gear up here ever again. So that professionalism was there under Caffrey. Like.
Right.
But then there was loads of variables that probably didn't get them over the line. You know. But a lot of county teams that played Dublin that stage in quarterfinals, semifinals would have said there was an ego in the Dublin change room.
And was there?
I think there's an ego in every change room. Yeah, but there's an ego that can give the opposition energy. Mm. That's what I'm talking about. So Conor Gormley, I think it is, of Tyrone, he talks about, you know, they used to say, okay, these Dublin lads have too big of an ego because they're coming up to the hill, pulling each other's jerseys, they're doing certain things that probably they haven't done, you know, they haven't won much to be able to do this stuff. So other teams got energy over it. We had a psychologist in around Gilroy's time, it was actually, who told us that when she was working with Tyrone, one of the motivators she done was she just basically put loads of news articles of the Dubs around the change room walls. Because a lot of these counties weren't
the only media stuff. Was it Niamh Fitzpatrick? No.
Caroline Currid.
Right.
She's working with Limerick. I think she might be finished this year, but she's worked with Tip, Limerick. She's done unbelievable in her art, in her field. So, so I suppose when Gilroy came in, Gilroy was very business astute. He'd done well in his business and he put a lot of work behind the structures and the culture. And then Jim Gavin came in with kind of a military culture added to that level then, you know. So
explain that a little bit more in every facet, like training to...
Yeah, like he would have gave us the opportunity to squeeze the potential in the group, if that makes sense.
Right.
So, you know, it's... If you meet someone and they talk and they're there to get advice off you and they talk so much, it's like filling a cup up all the way and it overflows. You're not going to be able to take that information in. So I think that's the easy way of explaining what Jim done. Jim looked at the energy, the knowledge, the potential in the group, squeezed that force and then started adding in more after it.
Did many players fall off in that process?
Oh yeah, but like...
That's part of
it. Yeah, it is, but not many. Like a changing room changes every year, whatever sport you're in.
Yeah.
In a team environment, like if you take one player out, change the environment. Yeah. Add one player in, change the environment, change the culture. So, Jim, the one thing everybody would say that's played under Jim would say he is like his attention to detail is incredible. Like you know, for example, we could be traveling down to Donegal or down to Kerry. All the lads would be reading books. right? And a few lads having the crack and everything else. But at some stage, most lads will be reading books. So again, they're learning the trade. They're getting more information from the outside to help them excel individually and collectively as a group. And he would walk up and down the aisle. And I'm sure he'd say, have the same kind of questions for every player he'd stop at. He'd be like, what's that you're reading? And it probably would go in his ear and out the other ear.
Yeah,
but
right.
Him showed keeping interest. You... Yeah. Yeah. I remember...
Showing that, like, make sure it's not a Mars bar.
Yeah. But I remember having the Constitution of Ireland. Right. Isn't that mad? I had the Constitution book. Yeah. And I was
well,
reading...
everybody should read it.
It's mad, like. So I was doing a bit of coaching. And I was getting to understand this book and how the country runs and everything else. And... basically, I was asked to go on the board for Goshka. Myself and Justin McAleese were the chosen two by President Higgins. And I said, look, if I do this, I want to get coaching on how the structures of the country is and all this. And the first thing I was given was the Constitution. So that weekend, I'm reading on the book and reading this book, and he's walking up the aisle and he says, what's that? It's the Constitution of Ireland. And he didn't. And he probably thought I was checking in on him to see was he actually checking the books, you know. He says, give us a look. So I showed him and he went, that is the weirdest book that I've seen on this bus. So yeah, but you'd have Jack McCaffrey reading a big massive book, but he's more into the sci-fi stuff and Harry Potter's and all that, you know. But
he's a doctor, isn't he?
He's a doctor, yeah.
Wow, it's incredible, you know.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
And you mentioned there at the beginning, Philly, that there was 9 of the Ballymun Keegans guys on the, was it the minor panel or the double?
21s. You
know, the 21 side, like. And was that core group then, did a lot of them, were you make it to the senior team? Was that where your All-Ireland success back in? Was it 2011 that you just won?
2011 was the first one, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say out of that group, potentially, I would say four that I can think of went on to play senior football with Dublin. Myself, Alan Hubbard, Davey Bourne, Jason Whelan. There was 4 of us. But the others probably have been brought in for trials.
Yeah.
And then Dean Rock James came probably a year later. They were younger than us.
Yeah. And I probably know the answer to this, like, but which meant more, winning it with your club or with your county?
Well, we didn't win the All-Ireland of the club. We got to the final.
Oh, you only got to
the final? Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Nice, thanks.
Oh, that was Bridget.
2013, we got beaten.
Definitely didn't know the answer.
Yeah, we got beaten in the last 30 seconds.
I thought you lost one and won one.
No, we won 2 Dublin championships and...
You're rubbing the dullest in it now.
Yeah. 2020, you can never say you'd go on and win that, but like we would have a good chance of winning All-Ireland. Yeah. That was the COVID year. We blitzed everybody in Dublin and there was no... Because we couldn't travel outside of Dublin, so there was no Leinster or All-Ireland.
Well...
But it's that's sickening for me, like, because...
Oh, you knew there was one.
But that's like...
Yeah, Bridges is a small...
They got back to the final last year.
That's right, yeah, they were there last year, because I know that club well, actually. Yeah. Yeah, it's right on the border of Athlone, you know what I mean? I would have played against a lot of those boys in soccer, funny enough, when I was in Athlone for a long time, and I'm just like going, Jesus, where are they getting the catchment, the players to win in All-Ireland? It's just unbelievable how small that neck of the woods is, you know?
But it does challenge the belief about population.
All you need is enough of them to buy in, I suppose, really, don't you?
Yeah, we were beating them, so, like the crazy thing was, before the game, I'd been playing midfield, and me mate, I don't know anything about gambling. I honestly, my dad didn't gamble, I don't gamble, I don't have a clue about it. He said to me, the odds are this, I wouldn't know what it is. I'm not interested either. And a mate of mine says, what's the story on you scoring a goal now that you're playing midfield? And I said, yeah, there's a chance, but very low compared to the forwards.
yeah.
And what he didn't know was I was starting full forward.
Oh, Jesus.
So I didn't say that.
Nice of you to tell us that, Philly.
I didn't say that because I wouldn't say it. Like,
yeah.
You know, because I've been probably trained by Dublin not to, you know, you keep that even to your family.
You keep that to yourself.
Like, you know. So anyway, I start full forward. The first ball comes in.
I do know the answer to this one.
Dean scores the first one. I scored the second one.
Yeah.
The second goal. And after the game, we obviously got beaten. But after the game, he comes up to me. He's delighted. I'm like, get away from you. Like, I went to losing and you're giddy and buzzy. And he's like, I just won a grand on you. I was like, what? He says, any time scorer.
Oh, yeah.
No way.
Yeah. And he said, I had money on you to score first as well. So he would have won,
a proper amount,
you know.
Yeah.
And I said, did you know I was going to start full forward? And he said, no. But I wondered, what did one of the lads tell him or something like that?
Yeah,
because
it
was such a coincidence, like, you know.
Wow.
But yeah, look, the whole of Ballymun was there that day. That was the incredible experience we had. And we lost, I lost my brother that year, 2012.
Yeah.
It went into Paddy's Day in 2013. But
I mean, I read your book fully. It was just the most heartbreaking, just the whole thing and trying to help him. And I suppose, you know better than anybody, if someone doesn't want the help or grasps the help, it's nigh on an impossible task, isn't it? But it has to be one of the most heartbreaking reads, like, because I mean, having known you at that point,
is that because you're seeing Dublin won All Ireland's in there?
No, to be honest with you,
there's very little football in the book, isn't there?
I'd be way more heartbroken coming into your life
or onto your periphery. You
John was 7 years older than me,
right?
But when I'd say for me, like, I kind of started to understand John was struggling at probably 17 or 18, maybe.
He was
17 or 18, so I was about 11 or 10 or 11, like, you know.
And did you know what was going on, or did you just think he was sick? Or
look, he was hanging around with a group of lads that were into the rave scene in Ballymun in Dublin at that stage, and the timing of John going being a teenager at that stage was just wrong for him, like, you know.
Right.
And then we know at the age of 25 he got diagnosed with schizophrenia, so we know he was self-medicating, probably experimenting like a lot of his mates at the start and a lot of kids in Ballymun, but then eventually there was a self-medication process to it. So it was just difficult for us as a family. We didn't know how to deal with it. Still families today in society in Ireland don't know how to deal with the situation. I travel when I can around the country to speak on the topic, and, you know, family members, parents are just, they don't know what to do. Like, you know, they're not getting enough support around. There's brilliant organisations out there, but there's still loads to be given and support.
It is absolutely out of control at the minute.
Yeah,
it is.
Well, cocaine,
weed
are two normalised drugs in society right now, and it's very worrying because we have, you know, serious issues with, you know, kids taking drugs that don't know what's in it, like, you know. And you know, it's all about finding, like, if you want to stop drugs, you have to make it uncool.
Yeah.
And right now, the reason why cigarettes is becoming, there's more people giving up cigarettes than smoking right now, is because it's uncool now.
Uncool,
that this is
right.
Vaping.
Yeah, the vaping's there. Yeah.
And there's 100 different types of drugs.
I was in a pub about 2 months ago in rural Ireland. I don't want to say where, but it was a Wednesday night because United played Chelsea, and we went to a wake, a funeral. Someone I knew had died, and my older brother was with me, and younger brother was with me. And anyway, there wasn't 10 or 12 people in the bar outside of us. People just kept going out. And I turn around to my older brother, because they're going by the front, and there was a big screen in front of us, and we hadn't seen each other in a while, and we all just kind of met up for this wake or whatever. And I was like, where's everybody going? Like, what's going on? And then my younger brother, we think he's a baby of the house, but he's 37 now. Like, he's not a baby anymore. But
he
turns around, and he's like going, what do you mean where they're going? He goes, like, they're going out to do lines or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? On a fucking Wednesday night in the arsehole of nowhere. I goes, why? He goes, sure. Who knows, like, you know what I mean? I mean, literally now I'm talking about the depths of the winter, bucketing outside, nothing else happening, and just 10 random dudes in a bar in rural Ireland, and all of them just going in and out doing lines.
Yeah.
Sad.
It is.
You were able to focus in on your sport, obviously, even though this was going on around you.
Well, I was fortunate that I had an example, some people would say a bad example, or John was a role model to me in that aspect in life, because I seen the pain and suffering he was going through, and that completely deterred me from it, because I had friends that were going the exact same route as John, so I could see it in them, and a lot of them ended up in prison. I work in Mountjoy now, and a lot of them are out now, but when I first went in there, there was about five of my mates in there, like, you know. So
must be tough.
Well, look, I kind of, everybody has to take responsibility what they've done in life, you know, yeah. good or bad. So if I could have helped them in there with the work I was doing in Mount Joy, that was great. But I was trying to help anybody in there that were kind of going the same direction of me, brother, because I would have liked that. Mm. I would like someone to go in there that maybe these fellas would have felt that this individual cares and he's relatable and he's from a certain area and he has an experience.
Did you ever have any opportunities with your brother, like, to talk to him? Like, obviously you were training and you were pushing on, and I'm sure there was times where you got to talk to one another.
We'd never have a deep conversation about his addiction, but he, as we became adults, he'd always talk about trying to go into recovery, and that was
constant. Did he try?
Yeah, he did, yeah. And, like, even, it's crazy to think that the law we have today in this country, if basically there's a 3-strike policy. So if you are caught with drugs on the streets, the guards give you basically a slap on the wrist, second time slap on the wrist, and you get charged the third time. So it's basically saying guards will deter people that are struggling with drug addiction, and once you get punished, you'll stop taking drugs. That's not the way it works.
No.
So John had went through so many cycles of going into recovery, going on to methadone, and methadone is obviously a drug.
Really addictive.
Yeah, it's a drug that makes you a bit, they say, make you a bit more societally functional, and it's difficult as well because it doesn't really, like, I mean, when you look at it in Portugal, it works really well over there. It's like an ice cream van coming around, and you'd stand there, and there's people coming up in suits, driving cars, and they take it and off they go, like, you know, and they're functional.
And why do you think it works different over there?
It's accepted a little bit better.
There's no stigma around it.
There's no stigma. It's accepted, you know. So whereas we have a huge stigma around the people that take drugs over here. Yeah, even that word is disgusting. Junkies,
yeah,
you know.
It's sad. It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like the bottom of the bottom of society, you know. So
the first thing you think about is friends, or in your case, friends and your brother. Family, you know what I mean? Like, in family. And do you know, it's such a just throwaway word and horrible.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Yeah. For having a family member, I just can't put into words how disgusting that makes you feel, like, you know.
Yeah.
But it's, look, John, with the education we had and we used tough love, you know, we said, right, well, me particularly, I was like, look, I'll ignore him, I won't talk to him. You know, and that'll be, love is the strongest connector we have, and that'll make them change, but it wouldn't. You have to remember, some people will take heroin and die and come back to life and still take it. Mm. That's how powerful drugs is. Someone can overdose, which is die, be revived, come back and still take heroin.
You know,
that's how dangerous.
My brother-in-law is a fireman, and he was like, you often bring them back and they're annoyed with you. He's like,
yeah,
dude, you were dead.
Mm.
But, you know, you've taken that high away, because when you give them that, like, it literally brings you back to sober.
And I've never taken a drug in my life.
Wow.
And when I played, sorry, we won in All-Ireland, and we went to Bali on the team holiday. And we came back in January, and we were playing Kerry. Played the game. The next morning, we went in for a recovery. And I don't know if any of you have been to Bali, but everybody gets this thing called Bali belly, which you struggle with, like, here. I didn't get it. Weirdly enough, everybody got it. I didn't get it. That's probably the dullest in the
party. Praying.
But I got home, and the next day after the Kerry game, we were in for recovery, and I got home, had food and everything. And I said, "Jeez, my stomach's not great, Sarah." And she says, "Take something, like, so I think it's a Motilium or something like that." And I was like, "This is not going." So luckily, I had, you know, playing in the Dubs, you have contacts with the doctors and stuff like that. So I rang the Dublin doctor, and he says, "Get into the hospital straight away. Your appendix is going to burst."
Stop.
So I went in. I was agonizing. Like, I stood up. The nurse called me, stood up, and collapsed. Right, completely blacked out. Collapsed. Woke up. One of the doctors came around and says, "Here, take that." It was like, I think it was Oxycontin or something like that, which is an opiate. Like,
yeah.
I was like, "No, it's still bad." Right, says the nurse. Hear him saying to the nurse, "Get him morphine." I got morphine, and I swear to God, it was the best feeling in the world.
I know.
It is incredible.
I know.
You're on a hot bed, and you're just, like, happy.
Mm.
And my wife is there, and this is how happy I was.
The best of year, yeah.
Yeah, this is what I said to my wife, right? I says, I start talking about Nafina. Now, Na Fianna are their rivals. Ballymun Na Fianna, like, for years have been rivals.
Yeah, yeah.
And I start talking. I won't say what I said. I start talking positively about
Fianna. Yeah.
And you know what she did? She recorded
I was going to say, she took a video. She
absolutely recorded me. And I was out of my head.
Yeah.
But the point of the story is, drugs are good.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
particularly if you're in pain. Yeah. Now, I was in physical pain.
Yeah.
You could argue that psychological pain is worse than physical pain, because it's not about just putting in a cast or you know, taking a tablet. Like, it's people that you see on the streets now, they're the most complex people that are struggling with addiction, right? They're the people that are lives are so much in turmoil, like, and this substance takes it all away.
Makes them feel better, yeah.
Like, think about it. You've got this little bag of heroin, takes you completely away from the world. Or you can get your life together and you can go, and this is how you do it. You go get support. You have to go and get social welfare support. You have to go and get key working support. You have to go into recovery. You have to get money from somewhere to do all these things. It's so much more complicated than it is to take this bag of heroin. And that's what
and
they
you
do.
You feel crap all the way through until you...
And you have to go you have to go through your withdrawals, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So then you finished playing football, just to move the conversation along, if you like.
Yeah.
And you went into the world of business. Or was that start while you were playing football? Or?
Yeah, it did, yeah. So I started my business I was always in the fitness industry first. So I started that when I was first year 21. And I started that because I was broke. I had this car that I bought up in Armagh and I was on the Dublin 21s and I had a €13,000 loan. That's the way we do things in Ballymun. We put ourselves into debt.
Credit union.
Yeah, yeah. I had this loan from the credit union and I said to me, man, I was working in the gyms. I said, look, I'm going to go back and repeat my leaving cert to get a degree. I was working in DCU at that stage and I was surrounded by students. So I felt comfortable enough, whereas none of my family or friends had done it. So there was no real pathway.
Yeah.
But I did have the guidance of Paddy Christie and Ian Robertson and Niall Moyne.
I was going to say Niall Moyne.
Yeah, he was important as well. Yeah. So
Did you do your leaving?
Yeah, I did, but I only got 250 points. So it was only like tick the box type thing.
Right.
But then I went and done a PLC course in the fitness industry. Started working as a lifeguard at 17. But when I repeated my leaving cert, I was going into school broke and I had this car and everybody, I'm sure the students were like, is this fella a teacher or a drug dealer? Like,
yeah.
You know? But I was absolutely broke because I'd have €2 a day and I'd get a bottle of water and I'd... He's going to hate me for this. I'd make a sandwich, a ham sandwich. That was me cooking skills at that stage.
Nothing wrong with a ham sandwich.
Oh. But I was broke, absolutely broke. €2 a day. And my mum and dad looked after me, obviously, but I just didn't want to over-rely on them.
Yeah.
So I started training a couple of teams in the attic space in Ballymun Kickhams. And that basically grew into a business and a gym. And so I was very fortunate to see the opportunity for us in that. After a couple of months of training the teams, that, you know, there's parents kind of around the club going, would you train us? Yeah, no, but and then I set up 4 gyms, but they were in kind of like small sports clubs. And then I consolidated them all to one big gym now in Finglas. So that's where I'm at now.
And when did the food journey come then, Philly, like the food company?
Yeah.
And you got bought out, you said there a while ago.
Well, we merged, yeah. So 2012, I because I hadn't done any business in school, business studies in school or in college, it took me, like, I was like a lot of business people, you get to a stage where you try adapt because there's certain things happening in that industry. So the fitness industry started to be saturated in Dublin, because when I started I was getting really good results out of people because they're small numbers and I wanted it because I needed money, and then their friends came and there was referrals and referrals and it grew so big that it was hard to keep the personalisation in the gym.
Yeah.
But then what happened was, you get a lot of people, particularly in Irish society, that go, I can do what he's doing. I'm going to go and set up a gym and I'm going to go and make money out of it. Fair enough, that's great. But they take clients with them.
Yeah.
And you start to dilute your market. So at that stage, I went, oh God, I'm going to have to put my money into something else here.
Yeah.
So I set up a ready-made meal company called Fitfield. And it was kind of an opportunity, but a mistake, you know, because I just didn't realise what I was doing wrong. So when I set that company up, I then went and got business coaching and realised, holy crap, I haven't done half the things I should be doing right here. So then went back into the you know, got the head down and got stuck into the fitness industry, because every time I've hit a plateau in the fitness industry, all I've had to do is outsource consultancy and see what I'm doing wrong, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And you got taken over, Leonard, but you,
yeah, we
you've stayed on though as a partner or director?
Yeah, co-owner, yeah, to NutriQuick. Yeah, so NutriQuick is doing really well. It's in most retail outlets. So we sell, like, I think we're up to about 60,000 meals a week.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's doing really well. We're in we've a manufacturing unit in Blessington. The GAA and the GPA are partners now in terms of the products that we sell. And
who's your biggest client then? Is it like
Aldi?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's Aldi. But Aldi then, so is everything retail then, or is there personal clients as well, as in like regular households or whatever, the way that business would be in a lot of parts of America where individuals sign up to a to like an app or whatever, like, or a service, and they're just bulk buying all their ingredients. And say somebody now that's just like you at college, not married but living on his own, wants to eat properly but wants to eat right.
Yeah,
do you do a bit of that too, or are you just I did with solely Fairfield. Retail?
Yeah, I did with Fairfield.
Fitfood was that
for scale?
Yeah,
you can't do that. Like,
no, you need the distribution.
It's retail. Like, that's where it is. Like, so. 2 years ago, we won a contract with Aldi worth $9 million over 3 years.
Yeah.
That was a massive win for us.
And they're good to work with.
Yeah, they're really good to work with. And I don't want to dismiss anybody else.
No, but I mean, really good Lidl, Aldi, all. I mean, I've done lots with loads of them, and so has Gareth over the years. But they nearly help you along in the journey as well. Like, you know, where you might have a shortcoming or whatever. Like, you know, we believe in the product. There'll be somebody here that can help you with the other wee bits and pieces.
Yeah, don't. Well, I've been through with other.
And then you piggyback on that, and you're up and running. But yeah, good for you, man. That's unbelievable. 60,000 feeds. Yeah, do you get your hands?
So where does most of your time get spent? Is on the gym?
Gym. Yeah, but more so in the office, working on the business. You know, so I've got goals. I won't share them, but I've got goals for the business. Like, I think in business, the one thing I've learned is if you've got a business and it's a particular part of an industry, it's discovering where the opportunity is. So it might be you having a kitchen, but seeing then, hold on, there's much more money to be made in making a product or something like that. I'm just throwing that out there on your end. But it might be a gym, discovering you can achieve something in a gym and then scaling that to something that most gyms need. You know, that's what I look for now. It's where's the opportunity? So I know I'm not going to be a multimillionaire from owning one gym, but where's the opportunity from owning one gym, and who can I support from that? And that's where my headspace is at the minute.
Cool. Brilliant.
Well, look, we usually wrap it up every interview it used to be cookbook or whatever it was, but nowadays we sort of say, like, your dream, your death row dinner. What would be your dinner. Considering you
After you've eaten your coddle, what would you be
after you've buried a feed of coddle and
after the coddle and a NutriQuick meal? Self is plugged there, but,
and feel free to plug away.
What would it be? The only thing that I would feel is better than a steak is lobster.
Yeah,
you know,
I was just
you can have both. You can have
a I was just looking at me going, I see a steak in the sand somewhere.
But it's boring.
That's a pricey.
I'd be a steak as well. One last thing.
Yeah, I think we both.
What's your quote? What do you like, fillet or what?
But you know what? It's a bit of it mixes. Like, I used to be fillet, but I love a ribeye, and when I'm going out for a meal with Sarah, is a Chateau Briand.
Yeah. Oh yeah, amazing. Sharing.
I think that's nice. But the nicest steak I ever had, and this is going to sound so bad, I'm sorry, from the fella from Ballymun, was over in the Cayman Islands. And we were over there with Dublin, and basically...
Yeah, but Dublin doesn't have any money, right?
We get paid, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Bally and
he sold his car to go over.
Yeah, it's the odds.
Yeah.
But look, the thing with Dublin is we don't have as many diaspora from the west of Ireland traveling to the States, becoming multimillionaires that we can go over and sponge off.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying other counties do that. I'm just, you know. But I suppose there's opportunities when you do well in Gaelic football, and team holidays are definitely, we're very, very lucky, but we've won an All-Ireland.
You earned
them. Get over to them, you know. But there was basically, we went into this restaurant in the Cayman Islands, and there was this big sign. It was like, do you ever see the ad of the is it the Kinder Bueno? I was like, eat me, eat me. That's what it was like for me. I was looking at this size of the steak. I don't know what size it was.
Yeah.
It's like, are you challenging me?
Yeah. All over
I'm
it.
I'm going for you. I don't care how much you are. I'm going for you. And the lads are all around me, and I'm eating this big, massive steak. There's nothing else. It's a huge steak. But it was beautiful.
Yeah.
I think it was a T-bone steak.
Yeah.
Like that, maybe a tomahawk. I don't know what it was. It was gorgeous. Very nice.
Did you make it all the way through it?
I didn't. I struggled to walk home. Yeah. I think I got put in the trolley.
You got
and
the
pushed
T-shirt.
Home. Yeah, yeah.
But well, listen, right. Thanks a million for joining us, Philly. You were deadly. And I'm glad we got you. We got you in right at the tail end of season two. Thanks very much. And best of luck with both your businesses. I hope they keep pushing on. I'm sure they will, knowing you.
Okay, so it's our favourite part of the podcast now, where we throw it over to Ed Schiff. And he gives us culinary conundrums. What have we got?
Loads of emails in, as usual. I've pilfered three, starting off with this from Julie Stack in Westmeath. Interesting one, this. I've been tasked to make haggis for my in-laws, father-in-laws from Edinburgh. I am planning to use casings instead of sheep stomach.
She's going
to
make it.
Yeah, but what could I substitute for the sheep's lungs? My God, not available in my area. Other than beef tripe, I am drawing a complete blank here. Help. That is maybe the most specific question we've ever had. So basically, she's planning on using casings instead of sheep stomach.
The only thing I would say is, right, and look, I've made, the only comparison I can give you is that I've made sausages load of times, and sometimes I couldn't get the skins.
Yeah.
So we use an ingredient called crepinet.
Yeah.
Which is basically, it's the fat lining of a pig's stomach, and it's readily enough available. Your butcher will definitely be able to get it to you, for you. But the only time I've ever cooked haggis, and I've cooked it for Burns Night for haggis neeps and tatties. So
yeah.
It's there, like it's their St. Patrick's Day. And I've always bought it from one of our food vendors. And the one I always try and buy is a Chieftain, which is a big haggis.
Yeah.
And then you just steam them. And the tradition is on Burns Night, it's carried into the room. And there's like a ceremony. They have a big sword and the chef carries it in.
Oh, yeah.
And they have someone that does this. Oh, I should know what it's called now. I've done it enough times. But they cut the haggis open, and the chef and the person that cuts it open has a nip of whiskey, and then you go back in and serve it. But if I was going to try and make haggis and I couldn't get the bladder or the intestine, I would be reaching for that. It's pig's gall is what the butcher might know it, but the French name is crepinet.
Right.
And we use it all the time for you making mousses and wrapping it around meats.
There are second class cuts and stuff like that there. But the only sort of trick with the crepinet is some of them is you know, you gotta make sure that you soak it in cold water. You gotta draw the blood out of it.
Also remember, it's coming from the intestine, so it is surrounded by what your intestine does, right? So it's very important that you wash it really, really well, because it can have a very irony flavour, and you know what that flavour is, right? So normally a little bit of salted cold water, wash it really well, then dry it, and then you'd put your haggis mix into the middle, and then you'd roll it like a sausage, and then you can, the wonderful things about pig's gall or crepinet is when you roast it in a pan, it kind of melts a little bit,
yeah,
but it still holds texture. It's delicious.
It's almost like a sausage, like where you use a natural casing or a synthetic one or whatever it be, but you never ever see the skin, like, because it just almost blends. It blends itself in, and crepinet will do the same. It holds everything together, but once you fry it, then, you know, so get that thing out of your mind. I mean, if you've ever eaten a sausage, you've generally eaten the lining of an intestine or a stomach lining or whatever it may be. It literally disappears, you know what I mean? It's a product.
Good question.
Great question. Julie Stack, good luck with that. Second question in here. Gary, what's your favourite turnip?
Yeah. Jeez, I've had a nightmare.
I'm only joking. This comes in from John. Hey lads, just wondering if you've any experience with Hexclad cookware. I know Gordon Ramsay is banging on about them. He has shares in the company, I'd say. If you guys use them, I'd love to know what you think. Cheers, John.
I pressed on one of these. It's in my algorithm because it's following me around all of my socials.
Well, it's following me around too. But Sully that was on here with us, what do you call the young fella? He's a brand ambassador for them as well in America. Look, it's everywhere because Ramsay got a lot of money, obviously, to promote them. It's like anything.
I haven't used them yet.
I haven't used one.
Do you know some of the star kitchens in the UK are using them as their cookware?
Yeah.
Which is very surprising that they're in.
And what's the selling point, is it?
Well, I think they're showing that they're holding up to the heat.
Non-stick and strength is their big one. I mean, Teflon and non-stick is obviously it's always something that makes you nervous, you know what I mean? Because Teflon's obviously the enemy of whatever, and I don't really know how they're made. But look, Ramsey isn't going to be endorsing too much bad stuff. It's not like he needs the money.
Very expensive.
Yeah, it's not like he needs the money, you know what I mean? Unless they just... But by all accounts, they look like a great range. I love the look of them.
Here, yeah.
I've never had them.
Paul Ainsworth is over in Padzo, which is a Michelin star restaurant. He's cooking with them in his kitchen.
He's an ex-Ramsey boy too, yeah.
So I'd say there's probably a bit of brand ambassadorship going on there as well. But it's supposed to be very high-end, very good quality, but it's expensive.
Yeah.
Come on, John, good question there. This is a long one coming in from Cork. Jason Delaney. Here we go. I've noticed that recipes and video tutorials about cooking steak in a pan at home very commonly call for butter, especially the technique of spooning butter over the meat repeatedly to develop a nice flavorful crust. However, I find I like the flavor better if I cook the steak in a high temperature oil like grapeseed oil and then only melt butter over the steak after it's finished cooking, right before I serve it. When I cook the steak in butter, the butter seems to brown or develop an overly rich flavor that doesn't work for me. Perhaps I'm using the wrong technique, or the fact that I'm using a non-stick pan instead of a cast iron pan has something to do with it. I'd be grateful for any advice from you both. Love the pod, Jason.
Well, actually, you're obviously cooking your steak right, and you're basting with the butter right as well, because every little flavor profile that he talked about there is spot on, and lots of people are probably looking for that richness or that nuttiness that a Bournazette really, because that's, you know, nut, when butter turns itself into almost a nut brown colour, like it's known as a Bournazette. And then, you know, I do it like that, and I would baste it and finish it. You might drop a couple of cloves of garlic and three or four sprigs of fresh thyme. That starts to wilt in the butter, so you're getting a mixture of the garlic, the herb and the butter as well. But by all means, a vintner's butter or a Café de Paris butter or just a regular garlic butter or what have you, set on a steak under a salamander or under a blowtorch on the steak, and you cook it start to finish in the oil and then you put the butter on, is going to have as good an impact as any. The only difference will be is that butter won't have developed any of that nutty, dark flavour. But both work equally well. But if the first method of basting isn't to your taste buds, what you're doing sounds amazing.
But also, I think what the mistake or what most people don't understand is no chef sears a steak in butter to start with. That's only how you finish it. So what he's saying is, what was his name?
Jason.
So you start it off in a vegetable oil or rapeseed oil and you get the cooking part done, and then you have to lower the temperature, and then you'd add like 100 grams of butter into the pan, and then you have to bring it to a stage called Bournazette or foaming butter, and it's that foaming butter. And if you have the temperature up to hot, it'll move past Bournazette, past foaming, and the butter will burn. And that's where most people make a mistake. Right. So what the chefs are doing when they're adding in the thyme and the garlic and the rosemary and the Bournazette, it's just finishing that steak to get that extra little bit of caramelization and flavour.
Delicious.
So you don't start off with the butter.
It did sound like he was finishing it with the butter.
Yeah.
I think what he's saying here is that he's seen people starting with the butter.
No.
He prefers to start with the
technique. Impossible. Burns too fast.
Okay. Yeah, it's a finishing technique.
Great stuff, Jason. And thanks to everyone who's been sending in questions for this season. Keep them coming for the impending season of food at goaloutnow.com.
So, another episode wrapped up. Philly, what an absolutely brilliant, honest interview.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. It's why we really, you know, went after him big time, because there was a couple of dates that we couldn't get him around Christmas or
Someone I would say is like extremely self-aware, and, you know, anytime we're in the presence of somebody that's very good at something, be it an athlete or a chef or anything, you can tell why they have success, because they're so dialed into trying to move forward. And I remember when Mick was in that time, like, he spoke about sitting in his car and, like, after a bad service and just having that total reflection on how his day went, you know, where Philly was talking about the different managers that he's been under and how he's achieved excellence. And, I mean, he has, you know.
Being dropped and coming back getting in,
pulling
the team
on the Dubs jersey and, you know, picking up all Ireland medals like they were going out of fashion, which is almost impossible to win that many. I mean, I know them, so it is
possible. It really is. Yeah, but I mean, it's like, that's golden era.
And talking about, like, how honest he was about talking about his upbringing and his brother and,
yeah,
you know, how he got found his way through that. And so,
yeah,
a really brilliant guest. And our last guest of the season. Huh?
Yeah. So we're taking a wee break.
You're fancy
boys.
Exactly. I have a few bits coming up. I have a bit of travel with work and I'm going down to Florida on holidays with the kids. So we're going to take a couple of weeks off. So I know that a lot of you guys are tuning in every Wednesday. So now this will be the last episode and then there'll be a 2-week break. And I think we're going to be back around the 8th, I think, is the date that we're back. So
yeah,
please tune back in because we've loved having the listeners and we've loved growing the audience. And anywhere you are listening, please share it on your socials and because it's important that it gets out there and it keeps growing.
Yeah, we're over the moon, yeah. Like, we got the green light on another season, so things are going all right for us, thank God. We love chatting food with everybody. And
we just have to lock the contract in now for Ed Sheff, but I have a good feeling.
Producer over here, he's acting the Mbappe at the minute. But
I've got Daniel Levy on the case. Yeah, we're gonna, good luck with that.
We're going to tie him down. We're going to tie him down very shortly. But yeah, we're back on the 8th of May. And looking forward to getting stuck in. Hopefully Gareth will have a couple of wee foodie stories from his travels. You're going to some nice places. And I'll be knee deep in my new job in the K Club.
Yeah, so, that's all going well.
Yeah, brilliant, man. Yeah, we're up and running rightly. Yeah, May's probably looking like the busiest month of the year. Super. So, yeah, May, September. Look, the summer really kicks off after the Masters in a place like the K Club, you know what I mean? The Masters obviously was back in April there, mid-April. Anybody that golfs will tell you that that's their year up and running. Yeah, that's where it's at. Yeah, so we've got a...
But we'll still find time for dishing it out because it's definitely brought a new... it's brought a new energy for me for talking around people with food. Obviously, we do a lot of talking through radio shows and other bits and pieces that we do. But this is a... It surprised me throughout this series about some real standout moments. And I think the one for me... I mean, today with Philly, really, I mean, just it's amazing how honest people are. But when Una Leonard start talking about her story and some of the things she've overcome and how food brought her out to the other side.
I came off my chair in that episode.
I seen the big boy welling up and I was like, is he going to be all right here?
Yeah.
But she was amazing. And look, she paid us a really big compliment to say that she felt she was in a very safe space.
Yeah.
I think she knows that we obviously work in the same environment. So it's brilliant to hear that, you know, our industry and kitchens do get a bad rap from time to time, but obviously, if you're into it, you're into it. So that's really helpful.
And then an old boss of Una's who was so good to her, Nevin, was on in this past season as well. He was brilliant, you know. Jesus, Ed's still trying to recover from Nevin rhyming off a 9-course dinner menu for his death row meal.
I dream about it.
Yeah,
he wasn't going down hungry anyway. I can assure you of that. But you know, just the story of McNean House and getting blown up a couple of times and his mommy and daddy, God rest them, you know, bouncing back and then him taking it on with Imelda and just turning it into the juggernaut that it is.
But you can see why people want to go to McNean House when you're in Nevin's company.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, parking for a minute that you're going to eat amazing food, but I said it when he was in, I said it to him, I said it to you, he's just hospitality. He's just a really nice person. And, you know, when Mick was in, like a 2-star Michelin chef, he spoke about it as well. Like restaurants are, and hotels, they should be fun, welcoming places that you want to revisit with your family, with your friends, even on your own. Go into a restaurant on your own. That's an experience.
Well, that's a true mark of hospitality. And look, I mean, like I could safely say that's what the K Club is and I love it. I've been going to the Marker for a long time and, you know, you guys have done hospitality as good as anybody in the country. And those that get it really do get it, you know what I mean? And that's where a lot of these places stand out from the crowd, you know. So it's no shock that McNean House and Nevin, Chapter One, the likes of them, like, are at the forefront of Irish hospitality, and they will be for a long time.
So look, we've loads planned for the next series, but we, as I said, we're going to take a couple of weeks break. But please keep an eye out, tune back in, and we'll have lots of food filled fun next year.
Say that 10 times a week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.